Thank you for tuning in to another terrific episode of Critical Perspectives with Tony Macklin. In today's conversation, we'll be exploring the works of one of our most legendary actors, Jack Nicholson. You can read all of Tony Macklin's criticism and listen in to countless interviews with some of the most revered figures in cinematic history at his website, tonymacklin.net.
I gotta tell you, when I first started loving movies, the first movie that I fell in love with was Cuckoo's Nest. So obviously Nicholson was my first favorite actor before I really got on board with Pacino, and he's been my favorite ever since. But I do remember when I first started loving Nicholson, seeing a Siskel and Ebert episode, and they were asked, who's the greatest actor alive today? And they said, Jack Nicholson. Would you agree with that assessment, from the past 30, 40 years?
I have a really difficult time picking the greatest anything, whether it be the greatest book or the greatest movie ever made. He's brilliant, but in his way, I mean, who was it that just won the Emmy Award? And Jim Parsons. And when he was in his acceptance speech, he said, these other four can do things I can't do. And I think that's true of every actor, that something that is your specialty, somebody else couldn't do it, but you couldn't do it either. And one of the problems that happens to great actors is they get miscast. And one of the things that has always been, not always, but has been a rub since the film was released, a rub for me, is that about Schmidt, I think Nicholson was absolutely wrong for the role. Because when you go back to the 70s or the late 60s, or actually, and Nicholson was with Corman and made, in 1960, Little Shop of Horrors. When you go back, Nicholson is the embodiment of an age, of a time. He was ironic. He was alienation. Now, irony, not to give a whole lot of definitions, but as you know, irony shows things beyond the surface, things that are different from what they appear. Now, let me throw a question back to you before I make my play about Nicholson and irony. What is the state, do you think, in movies of irony today?
What is the state of it?
No, I think it's dead.
I think it's dead too. I mean, but your kind of crestfallen attitude towards about Schmidt, does that speak to that notion that, you know, well, that's it, irony in movies is dead for once and for all?
That's part of it, certainly part of it.
Dear Ndugu, you'll be glad to know that Jeannie's wedding came off without a hitch. Right now, she and Randall are on their way to sunny Orlando, on my nickel, of course. As for me, I'm headed back to Omaha. I'm driving straight through this time, and I've made only one stop. The impressive new arch over the interstate at Kearney, Nebraska. An arch that commemorates the courage and determination of the pioneers who crossed the state on their way west.
Fight of an Indian bride, myself.
You've really got to see it to believe it. And it kind of got me thinking. Looking at all that history and reflecting on the achievements of people long ago kind of put things into perspective. My trip to Denver, for instance, is so insignificant compared to the journeys that others have taken, the bravery that they've shown, the hardships they've endured. I know we're all pretty small in the big scheme of things, and I suppose the most you can hope for is to make some kind of difference. But what kind of difference have I made? What in the world is better because of me?
I mean, when you go back to the 70s, which is the golden age of films. Although I found an article that was I was interested in because I wrote it. I had forgotten that I had said that in the 70s, I'm writing in the 70s, and I said, films are not as good as they were in the 60s. And then I found out that, guess who said the same thing? That Ebert said the same thing at one time in the 70s. Now, we hadn't been steeped in the 70s and gone through Altman and Peckinpah and all the early personal films. We really didn't realize that that was going to be a time, a special time in cinema that would never be repeated again. But when you go back and you think of that era and that time, that Nicholson seemed to me to create a human character that just isn't in film today. I'm thinking about my best 10 of the year so far, list so far. And so far, this is the end of August, I have maybe two contenders. Maybe two contenders. Because the only thing that's in doubt today, I think, is whether it's a zombie or not. Is he a zombie or not? That's the only doubt we have. Everything today, it seems everything is literal. We live in a literal time. The 70s didn't. The early 70s, and the great thing about the 60s, also when I was introducing this idea, we go back and we think of the film that was listed in released in 1968, that you and I agree is one of the best movies of all time. I think we agree to that, and I think will be in 2022 that on Sight and Sound's decadal list of the best movies ever made, it will be number one on the best movies, and that is Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. But you also think about the late 60s and the Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde. And I know, as I was thinking of this, someday I think I'd like to do a program on Warren Beatty, because I think he is underrated as a creative force and a really crucial figure in film history. But Bonnie and Clyde was released.
And you know what? You know what? He just finished shooting his new film. He went back to directing. And so on the occasion that comes out, that will be the perfect moment for us to do that conversation. Because I agree with you. And for some reason, Warren Beatty is rarely in this dialogue when we talk about 70s rule breakers. But let me ask you this about Schmidt. If Alexander Payne had established that Schmidt had this kind of wild, very colorful past, and he settled into this old age doldrum, what would that have worked for you? Would that have been that level of
Well, first of all, you're creating an Alexander Payne that would never make that kind of movie. I mean, he made The Descendants, right?
Right.
And he changed the image of Clooney. Now, a lot of people are, Clooney was wonderful in that film. I thought, he could walk through it. I think that Jack Nicholson, in a way, has said he based his role, or not based his role, but he used Buster Keaton and Buster Keaton's wooden face and expression in making about Schmidt. Well, mm-hmm. Jack may be Chaplin, but he's not Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton was tremendously ingenious in his activities. Schmidt is not ingenious in his activities. I think the book is much better. If you've ever read the book, is very different. And I just have a real problem with that, because I think The Death of Irony is an important part of the death of our souls. I think I've said to you before that the line that I always relate to, Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote in Young Goodman Brown, he wrote one of the characters saying, evil is the nature of mankind. In the modern day, No, I don't think it ever was, but especially in the modern day, hypocrisy is the nature of mankind. Everybody's a hypocrite. You know, there's this tremendous elevation of freedom, but it's not freedom. It's freedom for me and mine at the cost of everybody else. And I think you need an ironist to point that out. And when you go back to the films of the late 60s and the early 70s, and Jack Nicholson was the perfect figure to do this because you had to deal with a character beyond the surface. There were levels, there were qualities, there were nuances in him, in his very being. In one sense, if you trace his career, one of the things that I noticed about so many of his roles is that there's a hostility, that many of his characters are hostile. Now, granted, much of it is repressed, but it's another level, another quality that's lurking in his character. With Jack Nicholson, he will sometimes play part of a role, and he's campy. He's shtick. He comes very close to shtick. And then a moment later, he's very serious. The character of Jake Giddies in Chinatown. Sometimes he is such a ham doing all of this acting in front of his friends and his cohorts, his colleagues, and then at other times he is really focused on something serious. The other thing about Nicholson is he often plays characters who are involved but are uncommitted. You go back to Bobby DePie in the Five Easy Pieces, and you can come up to so many of his characters. As good as it gets, he is committed to sitting habitually at his table in the restaurant, but the whole film is about a character, and he gets involved in her life and her son's illness, but he can't commit. And that's one of the wonderful things about him, that there's always that sense of the possibility of leaping, the possibility of going to different places, the possibility of different, of understanding different things. Schmidt is a one-dimensional character. A lot of people like that film. I think it could have been made to even a better film if they had cast somebody else than Jack. And it's the same way. I took a lot of heat, probably the most negative stuff. You know, I was a douchebag, a baby killer, and a slime eater, and all of this for my review of the Coen brothers' True Grit. I just thought, after you make a masterpiece like No Country for Old Men, why would you remake True Grit? To me, it just seemed a waste of their talent, their ability. They wanted to do it, and that's fine. But to me, that's one of their lesser films.
And I apologize for writing those emails to you after you posted that review.
No, you weren't alone.
I'm kidding. I didn't care for True Grit either. But let me ask you this about Jack, because no actor I can think of has such pronounced mannerisms that are so specific to him. I mean, from the arched eyebrows to the laugh to the kind of maniacal. I mean, he has definite Jackisms.
One of the problems is that they become jack-offs. That when he made Batman, for instance, there's another film that I kind of wish he hadn't made. Because from that point on, his mannerisms got heightened. People looked for his mannerisms and didn't understand or didn't relate or react to the humanity in his characters. I think there's a tremendous sense of the human condition in Jack's films.
Let me tell you about this guy I know, Jack. Mean kid, bad seed, hurt people.
I like them already.
Yeah, you know, the problem was he got sloppy. You know, crazy. He started to lose it. He had a head full of bad wiring, I guess. Couldn't keep it straight up here. He was the kind of guy who couldn't hear the train until it was 2 feet from him. You know what happened to this guy, Jack?
What?
Made mistakes. And then he had to...
Now you want to get nuts? Come on! Let's get nuts.
Tell me something, my friend. You ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? What? I always ask that of all my prey. I just like the sound of it. Never rub another man's rhubarb.
Normally when we consider the truly great chameleon actors, we think how they disappear from role to role. But a lot of that has to do with, you know, their mannerisms alter from performance to performance. But that's the whole question about what constitutes a great actor. See, I think great acting is bringing all of yourself to a role, different facets of yourself. It's not necessarily disappearing. It's never being more you than when you're in that role. I mean, the artist uses all he is to give life to a role.
We've seen that recently. I think what drew our attention, especially to the actor being immersed in his role, was what happened with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and also this year what happened to Robin Williams, who made his last film was The Angriest Man in Brooklyn, was about contemplation of death. Now I can't make that leap, but certainly that was not a film that he should make that would have relieved his. But when you think about the great acting, so much of it is connected. Most of it is connected to the great word. If you look at the film scripts that Jack Nicholson has worked with and the writers he has worked with, Bob Rafelson, who directed 5 Easy Pieces and one of my favorite, King of Marvin Gardens, and then later is the underrated Blood and Wine. I think, actually, they worked together, Nicholson and Rafelson, 6 or 7 times. This came out in 1996. Both Jack and Michael Caine were in the cast. What's really notable about those two actors and being in this film is that they are the only two actors to get Oscar nominations in each decade from the 1960s through the 2000s. 5 decades. That's a really remarkable accomplishment. David Mamet wrote for him. Sorkin wrote for him.
James L. Brooks knows how to write for Nicholson, too. I mean, in terms of...
Except in the last movie. The last one, and I can't remember the title. It may be the worst title in the history of modern cinema. Oh, here it is. How Do You Know? Huh? I leave the room and I forget what the title is. I forgot the film,
know.
Too. But,
you don't know. That's, yeah. That's the answer to the title. But I want to bring up one more point, because you were talking about Buster Keaton and about Schmidt. And
Sure.
In terms of merely being dialogue at a minimal and mostly being observational, didn't he do that to better effect in something like The Passenger, the Antonioni
film? Oh, absolutely. Well, if you put Payne and Antonioni in the same room, you'd only see one of them. I mean, Antonioni was brilliant. He's a brilliant director. And The Passenger also... The late 60s, or actually in the 60s, were the age where foreign film came to America. It affected American audiences. It affected American filmmaking. And it was personal, and it affected the personal artist or the personal individual attempting to create his vision on film. And you go back in 1960 was Breathless, was Godard's great film. Persona, Bergman's, was 66-68. Truffaut was Jules and Jim. I mean, there was so much, and Jack seemed to be, he's not foreign at all. I mean, you think of him as truly American. And that's one thing, incidentally, that's one thing about the film in was it 71 or 70, that Five East Pieces, that when I saw that, it seemed a new authenticity had come to movies. Now, we forget that because there were so many films after that that brought the authentic to our films. A lot of films came from the magic land and the, but there were films that were like Marty that were about ordinary men, but in Rafelson and Nicholson and their vision and their expression, they captured an authentic part of America, an authentic part of our culture, and an authentic part of our spirit as well. It's a very, very important film. And here's another director that isn't even known, Bob Rafelson. Oh, and he gave Nicholson, certainly he helped Nicholson with language and direction, and what is perhaps ironic, what should be and isn't, is that the three films that Nicholson himself directed, he only directed three, none of them is very good. Mm-hmm. None of them is, I don't think any of them is memorable. And it's kind of interesting that going south, Western, goes back to Nicholson's very early career with Monty Hellman, with the director Monty Hellman. You don't think of Jack Nicholson on a horse, and he made the Missouri Breaks. Nicholson seems to be a bridge or a figure that goes in places where he doesn't belong, mm-hmm. and yet he lives. He more than exists. He really is alive in those places, whether they be the West or whether they be Western United States or whether they be Italy or wherever they may be.
Well, I think you hit it on the head when you described him just now as being alive. I think that's what, more than anything, what distinguishes his acting style is there seems to be an absolute freedom to what he does. And I think that's what audiences always responded to him with as well. But the other thing that really impresses me, and I think this is another major component of what makes him great, you mentioned Bob Rafelson, and they did something like five movies together, and I think after Man Trouble they had a falling out. Is the fact that he worked with the very best, most interesting directors, that he would go from Milos Forman to Antonioni to Stanley Kubrick. He worked with people that pushed something new and surprising out of him, and he completely...
Here is it. So many of the great, like Clint Eastwood said, what he wanted to do is surprise people. People don't think of him as being surprising, but you look at his films. He made Bridge Over Madison County. He told the war from the Japanese point of view. He made, not very successfully, but he made Jersey Boys. And I think that's one of the great frustrations in the artistic creative personality is that you're not given many chances to surprise. You have to be the expected Now, don't use this as an argument against me, my judgment of about Schmidt, because just because he wasn't the Jack I know and love, that's not my judgment on his on the character and the performance he made. But what you just said, you look at many of the actors that are considered great actors. Redford, his peer. Interesting thing about Robert Redford. Most of my life, I grew up saying that 1937 was the year where the greatest year of the birth of American actors. Nicholson was born in that year. Warren Beatty was born in that year. Dustin Hoffman, Tony Hopkins, Jane Fonda on the feminine side. And I thought Redford, because I always saw about a couple of years ago, he changed his birth date from 37 to 36. I think he got caught in trying to pretend he was a year younger than he actually is. But the point about Redford that I was going to make is that he made, what, 9 films with Sidney, with director Sidney Pollack? And we think of the association, the great combustion between Scorsese and Martin Scorsese, the director, and Robert De Niro, the actor. Nicholson, in a sense, and you got to it, that he made a few films with Rafelson. I think he made 3 with Rob Reiner. And he made 3, and they were trying to get it right. I'm not sure they ever did. He made three with Mike Nichols. I have an interesting story. Not an interesting. When you say it's interesting or you're honest, that means you're dull and you're craven. So I won't say this is an interesting story, but I offer the story. I interviewed. Stockard Channing in one of my favorite interviews that I ever had, because she was young, she had just left college, and she had been cast by Mike Nichols in a film called The Fortune. And who were her co-stars? Jack and Warren Beatty. They were in the film, and so she goes into the room, and she's sitting in front of Nichols, and they're going to do a reading. And in come Nicholson's first, and she says he had on his shades, his dark glasses, and he was wearing a mink-lined Levi jacket. And he was hungover because they had just finished Chinatown the night before. And here she is, this young, very, very bright girl. She used words like eclectic and entrepreneur in the interview with me. I really liked her and have been a fan of hers on a personal level all of her career. And she said, I was like a cat with 2 dogs. And they roughhoused. They rolled on the floor. It sounded like they were frat guys. And she said, they fell on me, they rolled on me, and Warren came over and rubbed my head and said, you've got it, Stock, I think you got it. So she got the part. Now, the film was a trifle, and it didn't do anything. But the spirit that both Beatty and Nicholson shared is a fascinating one, because I think probably Nicholson wanted to be Beatty, in many levels he was, but as a director, he didn't achieve the stature, or as a producer, he didn't achieve the stature of his buddy Warren.
He and Warren are very interesting. I mean, they're best friends. They have been for so many years. But if you think about their differences, Warren Beatty, you always think of as the perfectly polished, coiffed, a Hollywood leading man. Nicholson, you think of the rabble rouser, the one that doesn't wear a shirt on. He can wear a shirt on inside out and wouldn't care, and So the interesting dynamic, cocaine,
it seems, makes the best of friends.
Okay.
Forget all sensibilities. Sensibilities out the window, or up the nose, or whatever.
Well, okay, but carnal knowledge is interesting. I mean, it's interesting.
That does work. That does work. Yes, that does work. Yeah. But the fortune, and then Wolf, didn't quite.
Heartburn.
Yeah. Oh, did he direct Heartburn?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I should have known that.
So they did four together, I guess.
Okay. All right.
But there wasn't
a director that was like the one with Redford and De Niro. Even though, in a sense, when you think of Jack Nicholson being directed, let me read some of the ones I wrote down. This is incredible. The list, and you hit on some of them. Kubrick, Scorsese, Miloš Forman, one of my favorite directors. He directed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Rafelson, Nichols, Beatty. Do you remember what film he directed with that Jack appeared in?
Yes, it was Reds.
He appeared in, you know, most actors are drawn to playing actual people who lived. And Nicholson never played Hitler. Didn't appeal to him. Of the very few, Hoffa and Eugene O'Neill, which he played Eugene O'Neill in the Beatty film, Reds. Polanski, Roman Polanski. Here's one from the past. In fact, you could win most of your bets at a cocktail party if you go to cocktail party. No, beer bash, whatever. If you say, who is it that co-wrote Head with the Monkees, directed, Drive, he said, and acted in, on a clear day you can see forever. And of course, it's Jack Nicholson, but that's a strange trinity. But he worked with Vincente Minnelli as well. John Huston, whose daughter he had the famous relationship, Ilya Kazan, Brooks,
right.
Reiner, one woman, Nancy Meyer, Tim Burton, Ken Russell. I mean, that's a phenomenal list of talent and different attitudes, different, very, very conflicting points of view.
Well, and his attitude was just the right one, because when he was working with these people, because watching the making of The Shining, he says, you know, when I'm working with a director, I want the director to mold me. I want to be out of control. I want him to actually direct me. And so when he does, this is how I always equate him with such bravery, because when he did The Shining, he was perfect for that vision of that character that Kubrick had, because he didn't care about naturalism either. He was creating something that kind of transcended an ordinary performance. He was creating something else, just like he did with Batman. When he did Batman, he said, I'm interested in creating a piece of pop art out of this character. And I feel like that's what he did. It was a different concept for a character that he could bring to life. But he did another Miloš Forman movie. He had a cameo role in another Miloš Forman movie. Do you know which one it was?
Wow. Hair. You didn't see him there? He was in the plane when they walked in. He's kind of in the dark, but he's
right
there. Take my word for it.
I'm sure.
I'm a critic. Take my word for it.
I will. I believe you all the time. He was in Ragtime. He played a pirate.
Well, that's...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. By the way, you and I could stand up to Colonel Jessup when Nicholson says,
you can't handle the truth!
We would say, yes, we can.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Just wanted to get that out.
So let's talk about his understated, his colorful work is one thing, but he has a tremendous amount of understated work in there too. Are you a fan of The Border, for instance?
Yes, yes.
We watched that a couple of months ago, and I was quite taken with it. And that's something that's very, it's one of his understated performances, even though he has, eruptions here and there in it. And he's a very powerful actor when he's still. It's that indefinable quality that a movie star has. What makes a movie star? Well, you can't keep your eyes off of them. You can't take your eyes off of them. And Nicholson has that. You always want to see what he's doing or consider what he's thinking.
Well, you sound like one of the reviewers that said you can't take your eyes off the screen. Why would you take your eyes off the screen? I mean,
it's the same thing with stage. I mean, I'm not talking about taking your eyes off the screen. I'm talking about taking your eyes off of him. He could be sharing a scene with someone, and your eyes are focused on him. He cannot. He might not be doing anything, but it's that sense of danger and the unexpected that he brings along with him. That magnetism, that you're just glued to him.
I agree. Absolutely. That he's a fascinating, interesting, but sometimes fascinating actor. And you and I, especially, I'll talk for myself, great fans of personal films. And Jack Nicholson was one of the ones that did not go the way that Redford did. I mean, he's a private person. He's a private person except at Lakers games. Except he is a private person at Lakers games because nobody talks to him, and he goes up to the Lakers lounge. And I had a student once that he said, "I've seen Jack Nicholson." I said, "Well, ask him a question." And so he asked Nicholson about in Five Easy Pieces when he's talking to his father, is he talking to God? And Nicholson just brushed him off and walked away and then turned around. And, here was a kid that knew, that at least had a thought about the movie.
Yeah.
And he got, but then somebody else asked him a question about Rafelson. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you, Bobby never wears shoes." And he left. So, by the way, here's another thing that has been on the rumor mill. And I'm sure you have followed it since you just love gossip.
I can never tell when you're being sarcastic. Okay, go ahead.
But just assume most of the time that I am. Never. I would never, ever be sarcastic or cynical or ironic or skeptical.
Yes.
None of those things even pass through my mind for a millisecond. But there has been in the last year some stories on various sites and various magazines that Nicholson is homebound, that he may be undergoing, he can't remember his lines. And so I knew I was going on with you earlier in the week, and I had donut break with a good buddy of mine, Al Bernstein, who is the boxing guru, and he has a good source, who's a friend, personal friend of Nicholson. And so he emailed him while we were sitting, and our conversation lasted for an hour and a half. As you know, I am wont to extend speech that long. And he heard from the friend, said, "It's a bum rumor. I talked to him 2 days ago, and he just played golf." So
right.
I don't know whether that's a cover story, but I would lean more to, we all forget something, right, John? We all forget an occasional thing, John.
Yeah. But, I don't think that he, I just think he doesn't want to work. And which is a loss to us, but when you've accomplished as much as he has, but people have been courting him constantly, as you can imagine, and I know that Tom Cruise is trying to mount this comedy where he plays a Secret Service agent guarding an ex-president who's really not very well liked. And Tom Cruise really wants Jack Nicholson to play the president, and he's been courting him hard. And that's
well,
the one movie that I think he's considering.
It has to be a killer of a script. He has reached a point where when you look back at Robin Williams, we forget. It was 12 years since Robin Williams starred in a major movie. I mean, he's been in movies. He's made appearance in movies, but in a quality movie. 12 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time. And I think that what the reason... Oh, another thing is Williams was getting forced, or at least feeling an awful lot of pressure to make Mrs. Doubtfire.
Mrs. Doubtfire, too. Yeah.
Two. And he didn't want to. I mean, he really didn't want to. And so Clint is pressured all the time and asked to make Dirty Harry 2 or Dirty Harry Wears the Pens or whatever it is. And so there really isn't imagination. And as I was suggesting to you before, and it's not, I hope it's not merely ageism. It's more context, that you remember what he was offered and the creativity that Jack could bring to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and that Milos Forman is such a humanistic director. He's such a wonderful humanist that his films are breathing with humanity. But what's he supposed to do? He's made Wolf, so Jack the Vampire? I don't think so. About Schmidt gets it right this time? I doubt it. So what is he to do if the product isn't there? And another thing is, and this really dates us, I'm not sure the audience is there. And this comes down to my question of comparing the 70s. Now, in many ways, this is a more informed generation, but informed often about trivia, and it seems like everything in every possible field is propaganda. There has to be spin on everything.
Right.
And so how many roles are there offered? Are there even available to an actor that wants to do quality and wants to do something that speaks to him and something that he can be proud of and something that challenges him?
Well, that's just it. And if he doesn't have, and there are a lot of great filmmakers that would cut off their left foot to work with him, I'm sure. But if he doesn't, bottom line, if he doesn't have the burning desire to go back into the ring, he shouldn't. And he's earned that right, you know.
Well, no, I think you're right, absolutely. And the other thing is, there's always I think he has left it on a down note, but nobody knows of it. I think he went out and burned all the copies of How Do You Know, the last.
Yeah, but
he still has
the bucket list, He actually loved the bucket list. He actually went out and did interviews for the bucket list.
Well, the thing about the bucket list, first of all, he'd worked before with Rob Reiner. And he and his co-star are the same age. Morgan is another actor. Morgan Freeman is another actor that was born in 1937. And so there was so much off-screen camaraderie and so much that made it onto the screen. And I don't have any problems with the bucket list being his last film. In fact, I wish, in a sense, that maybe it was his last film as an actor. Yeah, I think it was. Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino. That's the perfect exit for Clint from the screen. That you want to find something that, in a sense, finishes and yet leaves it open to, oh, I wish this guy would make another film. instead of saying, boy, his last films were his last films were disappointing.
Your point of view on The Bucket List, because I don't think it's a terrible movie. A lot of people go overboard and say that it is. I think it's quite watchable and enjoyable, mostly because of the chemistry, just enjoying watching the two of them together. It's what drives that movie. But there's like a preciousness about that movie.
Absolutely.
That I find at odds with how I view Nicholson's work typically.
Well, I guess it's like salt, that if I have 100% in about Schmidt and only 10% of sugar in The Bucket List, I can live with that.
Okay.
I think I wouldn't put The Bucket List as even a memorable film, but it's a nice, I don't think he has to be ashamed of it.
Right.
And it was probably, from everything I know of, a very pleasant experience for him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to be said for that.
What do you think Sean Penn was able to bring out of him in the Crossing Guard?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I think that maybe even more interesting was Morse in that film, who is an underrated actor, who has done an awful lot, but usually on the periphery. I'm not against the film. I'm not for the film. I think it's an interesting film, but I don't remember galvanic moments that Nicholson did. What stands out in your mind?
There's one moment. There's one scene in that movie where he completely breaks down when he's on the phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With his ex-wife about the murder of his daughter, and he finally lets it all out, and it's like a child's weeping that he can't even get the words out, and that was a level of torment and vulnerability that I'd never really witnessed from him before.
Mary, it's Freddy. Mary, please don't hang up, please.
Where are you, Freddy?
I'm falling apart, honey.
Freddy, what's the matter?
It's this fucking dream. It's sunny outside, and I'm driving my car, and it feels real big. It's driving me. And I'm driving past in school. The elementary school. There's a crosswalk. And all these little kids are being helped across by a crossing guard. Crossing guard is John Booth. And it's one of the little kids. I'm getting closer and closer. I'm in brakes. The car won't slow down. I'm turning the wheel. The car won't turn.
But I mean, I think an equally intriguing performance is the one he gave in Sean Penn's movie The Pledge. That's an interesting movie.
I prefer that film. I think I prefer The Pledge.
Yeah, me too. All right, let's go through just a couple of the titles that we haven't discussed yet. There's some movies that he probably felt obliged to do because he was such a natural for them. And, you know, Batman is one. I know the Cuckoo's Nest was one because he said people kept telling me, you have to do Cuckoo's Nest. You're perfect for it. You're born for it. And when he actually did it, he said, you know, people think I'm so natural for this part. They don't realize how hard I'm having to work to actually pull this performance off. They just think it comes naturally to me. But the devil is another one in The Witches of Eastwick. I mean, who else would
yeah,
you
but have? Let's go back. Let's go back to Cuckoo's Nest. Do you know how much they softened that from the book, from Ken Kesey's book? If you read the book, there's not near the viciousness. The black boys are malicious in that. The Nurse Ratched, not a whit of humanity, and he tears her uniform open, revealing these mammoth breasts. There's a lot of blood and more suffering. In the book, in the movie, and I think this was a wise commercial decision, that they changed it to from a mental institution to summer camp. There was a lot of frivolity there. Now there was starkness, and there was pain, but and I think an actor is when he's able to. If he played the role as it is written, it would be perhaps an even greater performance, but it would not be as marketable or as commercial. And in that role, one thing about Jack is that in that role, he is so damn lovable. He is really lovable in that characterization. And you don't think of love with Jack Nicholson, but it's just shimmering.
What can you tell me about why you've been sent over here?
Well, I don't know. What's it say there? Mind if I smoke?
No, go right ahead. Well, it says several things here. Said you've been belligerent, talked when unauthorized, been resentful in the attitude toward work in general, that you're lazy.
Chewing gum in class?
Well, the real reason that you've been sent over here is because they wanted you to be evaluated.
Yeah.
To determine whether or not you're mentally ill. This is the real reason. Why do you think they might think that?
Well, as near as I can figure out, it's because I fight and fuck too much.
In the penitentiary?
No. You mean why?
Why did you get sent over here from the work farm?
Well, I really don't know, Doc.
It says here that you went
ain't
around.
Up to me, you know.
Let me just take a look.
Ain't
at
up
it.
To me, though.
One, two, three, four. You've got at least 5 arrests for assault.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that?
5 fights, huh? Rocky Marciano's got 40 and he's a millionaire.
That's true.
That is true.
But, you know, I played McMurphy on stage. I've always been in love with Cuckoo's Nest. And
McMurphy on stage?
Yeah.
Was this after he was kind of tonic?
I played it all the way through. So he was
all the way through. Well, good for you.
From beginning to end. And I'm going to have to write a letter because our Nurse Ratched did not have mammoth breasts, and that would have changed everything for me. So I'm going to have to complain about that. Let's see what else is out here.
But you were able to conquer that restriction because you had a sizable performance. I mean, you were well endowed. So it kind of evened it out.
I was much thinner at the time. I did it in 99, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. I mean, that was such a freedom to that character. And that piece moves people beyond words. I mean, it has this power that just gets to people.
Have you given it up altogether? Have you given it up altogether, the acting?
Yeah. I did like 75 plays, and then I just kind of stopped. Wow. Real life kind of trickled in.
Now, wait a minute. I've told you before, there is no such thing as real life. There are different lives, different experiences. But when people say, that's the real world, no, it's not the real world. It's your illusion, perhaps delusion.
Yeah.
There's no real world. So... real life.
I can't eat imaginary food. So I mean, I have to go to a job. You know, that's what I mean by. Yeah. Let's talk about his matchup with Brando in Missouri Breaks. I don't know if you think that's a very memorable film, but what do you think about those two energies together? I mean, that was so heralded. Oh, the first time on screen with Brando.
Right. I think it's not a very good film, and I think that, again, Nicholson is wasted. I mean, you see him plant crops, see him ride his horse or sit on his horse, and we don't have the firework works or the great conflict that you expect when you see those two. By the way, did you know that Brando has a house next to Nicholson's house?
He doesn't anymore. Nicholson demolished it and made it a garden.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he bought the lot after he died, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Another reason for vodka after this, the conversation.
Nicholson used to talk about sitting in his toilet. He said, I have a perfect view of Brando's house from my toilet. So every time I would sit on the toilet, I would look over and think, what's Brando up to? Yeah. But, you know, in Missouri Breaks, I mean, Brando's obviously kind of undisciplined in that movie. He had a real don't-give-a-shit attitude about the whole shooting of it. But he's doing a lot of the stuff that Nicholson, we feel like Nicholson would do. In another movie, but you can't have two lead actors, you know, behaving that way. So Nicholson's kind of straitjacketed because Brando's the
he
one
is.
That's flourishing all over the place.
But I blame Arthur Penn.
Sure.
I mean, two characters can be, if the director finds the key, there can be that explosion. There can be, or at least that interest, that fascination, that uncertainty, or that being unsettled, but it's almost got too much stick in it. I mean, mm-hmm. Him wearing a dress. I know, but okay. So.
No, I agree with you. I mean, coming just like a couple of years after Last Tango, which was such a eruptive performance that, you know.
I remember. In fact, when I hear about that, I always think of you because you have really exalted that film for me.
I love it. Much to the consternation of my parents. They're like, why do you like that?
You didn't, or have they just heard you talk about it? You didn't
sit and
watch it with them, did you?
I remember being like 14 years old, and the scene where Brando says goodbye to his wife, and he calls her all these vicious names, and then he stops and says, I love you, I don't know why you did it. I said, Mom, Dad, you got to see this scene. I was so in love with great acting. And they were horrified. They were like, why are you watching this? Anyway, I want to talk about a couple of more titles.
I want to say a couple of things about The Shining. Stephen King didn't like it, which is also the good. It's a Kubrick film. It's Stanley Kubrick's work, based somewhat on a novel by Stephen King. Maybe Nicholson's most challenging performance, because as the character. He has, as the actor, he's playing a character who's playing a role. And so there's another dimension, or it's not just an actor playing a character, but it's an actor playing a character, playing a part, a role of this man going insane, or this individual losing it. And to me, what he does, I have mentioned this time after time. I think I mention this every time I talk to you about Paul Newman and Bob Altman's Buffalo Bill and the Indians, that it was the same thing. It was an actor, and you hardly ever see this, an actor playing a character who is himself playing a role. And to me, that is as challenging as it comes. And both of them nailed it.
Get a lot written today?
Yes.
Hey, weather forecast said it's going to snow tonight.
What do you want me to do about it?
Oh, come on, hon. Don't be so grouchy.
I'm not being grouchy. I just want to finish my work.
Okay, I understand. I'll come back later on with a couple of sandwiches for you, and maybe you'll let me read something then.
Wendy, let me explain something to you. Whenever you come in here and interrupt me, you're breaking my concentration. You're distracting me. And it will then take some time to get back to where I was. Understand?
Yeah.
Fine. And we're going to make a new rule. Whenever I'm in here, you hear me typing. Whether you don't hear me typing, whether the fuck you hear me doing in here, when I'm in here, that means that I am working. That means don't come in. How do you think you can handle that?
Yeah.
Fine. Why don't you start right now and get the fuck out of here?
Okay.
And there's something to be said, too, and this goes back to his complete trust in directors. He didn't know what the final effect of that performance would be, Nicholson in The Shining. He just said, he thought, how is this going to cut together? And he thought, am I doing this too broadly? So, I mean, his big motive in that movie was just give up to Kubrick. You know, obviously Kubrick is an artist that you can trust. He's got a proven track record. So,
he's an artist whom you can trust, but you have to be willing for him to show you as shallow and empty and vacuous. And a lot of actors' egos will not allow that. Would not allow that. And both Newman trusted Altman, and Jack trusted Kubrick, so that even if you make me vacuous, as a vacuous human being, I am better than as a full, exciting human being in some other film directed by somebody else.
Yeah. He also worked with Hal Ashby. Yes. And they were close friends too, around the time that they did The Last Detail, which is another volcanic performance from him in that movie.
Right.
And when we talk about Nicholson playing a lot of anti-authority characters around this time, here he is playing a military guy when everything's about discipline and authority and that kind of thing. How do you like him in that movie?
I like him, and I just, it's not one of my favorite films. I don't want to say I don't care, because it is interesting. I guess it just doesn't have my sensibility, and it just doesn't some of the dialogue rings stilted to me. I think it's an impressive performance. I think it's a memorable film. But it, for me, it's on my list of also-rans.
Right.
I mean, I know I'm a minority in that.
It's not among my favorites. It's he made so few movies, Ashby did, but it's not among my favorites. I mean, my favorites would be Harold and Maude, but especially Being There is the Ashby movie that gets
right.
me them.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, that's Enchantment.
Yeah, it really is. And that's something that's missing from movies today, too, Enchantment. You know,
yes, absolutely. Yeah. Another thing that's missing, and I was talking about alienation, and alienation was so fundamental a theme in the late 60s and the early 70s. A man or woman not in a world that they could connect with, or not being alone, being isolated, and their sense of loss and their sense of wandering. And you brought up another theme that was, see, when I hear, and I don't mean this, but so many things are cheapened today. Mm-hmm. Everybody who wears a uniform is a hero. Well, what does that mean about someone who actually does a heroic act? If you make everybody a hero,
mm-hmm.
then the actual, to use the word true hero is lost. It's cheapened. And in the way back in the 70s, there was a strong anti-establishment. Now the establishment is taken over. When the school I'm at is, I'm not there anymore, but I left the University of Dayton because it was becoming a corporation. Well, all of the schools of that level, the school I graduated from, Villanova, it's just a business school. And so the arts, if they're recognized at all, they are the feeble stepson of the money-making machine. They would much prefer that teachers not be educators, but they be babysitters. No, I'm talking in generalities here, but there is a corporate sense of life in America that these people who made me, in a sense, in the early 70s would be destroyed in. I love the scene, and of course one of the great things about Nicholson also is how many classic lines, like "Here's Johnny" and the Colonel Jessup line, you can't handle the truth. But there are so many classic lines. I can't think of another actor. Can you? That
no.
has more classic lines
Pacino
identified with him. Yes, Pacino.
Yeah.
Pacino is right there. Yeah. But one of the, and I'm sure you remember it, is when he wants to order toast in the diner.
I'd like a plain omelet, no potatoes, tomatoes instead, a cup of coffee, and toast.
No substitutions.
What do you mean, you don't have any tomatoes?
Only what's on the menu. You can have a number two, a plain omelet. It comes with cottage fries and rolls.
Yeah, I know what it comes with, but it's not what I want.
Well, I'll come back when you make up your mind.
Wait a minute. I have made up my mind. I'd like a plain omelet, no potatoes on the plate, a cup of coffee, and a side order of wheat toast.
I'm sorry, we don't have any side orders of toast. I'll give you an English muffin or a coffee roll.
What do you mean you don't make side orders of toast? You make sandwiches, don't you?
Would you like to talk to the manager?
Hey, Mac.
Shut up. You've got bread and a toaster of some kind?
I don't make the rules.
Okay, I'll make it as easy for you as I can. I'd like an omelet, plain, and a chicken salad sandwich on wheat toast. No mayonnaise, no butter, no lettuce, and a cup of coffee.
A number two, chicken salad sand. Hold the butter, the lettuce, and the mayonnaise, and a cup of coffee. Anything else?
Yeah, now all you have to do is hold the chicken, bring me the toast, give me a check for the chicken salad sandwich, and you haven't broken any rules.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
I want you to hold it between your knees.
That is the fundamental focal moment for me with Jack Nicholson. The language was so brilliant by yeah. Rafelson and Nicholson in that film. And I miss that so much. That have how many films have you seen this year that have a great script, great dialogue? To make one final aside, and then I'll let you have the form for the rest of the time. But the reason why I like the picture. And my wife saw Al Pacino in town in Vegas. He did a one man show.
Yes.
Where he had the audience and you went. It was like the show that Gregory Peck gave or the show that Cary Grant gave.
Yeah,
and
I went and saw it. Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see it in Vegas. I saw it when he brought it here to Clearwater in Florida. But,
great.
Yeah.
Great.
He's my idol. He's my idol. So anytime
yes, I know that.
Close to him.
I like, and the reason why I brought up the Pacino was he took his kids to see Guardians of the Galaxy, and they all loved it.
Uh-huh.
So he was really into that film. But in Guardians of the Galaxy, it just loses me when the guy is making a smart remark, one of the characters, and he says, the Maltese Falcon. And I scream at the screen, it's Falcon, you idiot, it's Falcon. I watched the movie the other night. It was on Turner Classic Movies. And at least 10 times, a character, Bogart and the rest of them, said, the Falcon, the Falcon. After the film was over, Bill Hader came on to talk about it, and he said, in the Maltese Falcon, what's left? What is left?
What the hell is Bill Hader talking about?
Well, he appeals to a certain audience.
Yeah.
I have nothing against him, except
I know they bring out guest programmers, and that's just a curious... Bill Hader chose the Maltese Falcon. So that's just a weird kind of combination. Anyway, I wanted to say, don't you think, though, that brief period in the 70s where the kids were running the candy store, and then the candy store figured out, hey, we can make so much money off of these kinds of movies, and it became more corporatized again. Don't you think that kind of runs parallel to the culture itself and our involvement in the war? Because you can look at music too, and you can say, man, there were such thoughtful, the art of the protest song, which we've completely lost. And you have Dylan, and you had these pure singer-songwriters, and then after the war ended, we got stupid again, and then disco took over. And that's a direct reflection of how we just wanted to put our brain on freeze. We didn't want to think about the ramifications of anything. We're tired of trauma. And
I think that's absolutely true. That something like that, people had to think. People had to be skeptical. Nobody's skeptical except if you're a Republican. You're more than skeptical about the Democrats. If you're a Democrat, you're more than skeptical about the Republicans, liberal, conservative, and so forth. But there's very little thought, and therefore there's very little dialogue because, as I was saying to you before, talent is always battling with celebrity, and celebrity has won out in the present day. And I hope that people still write. I know they still write, and there's still language, and there's still dialogue. Another thing that's driving me nuts is improvisation. I mean, geez, I loved Olivia Wilde until she made, I mean, she was one of my favorite actresses, and she made a film, Drinking Buddies something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she made up her own dialogue. It was improvised. And it's like Pryor once said, my daughter would bring these beautiful girls home, these beautiful young girls home. And I'd look at them, and then they'd say, hello, Mr. Pryor. that would be the end of it.
I'm not a big fan of the improvised movie either. I think that it's an attempt at authenticity, but it's completely different from capturing an authenticity.
No, because it's fake. Much of it is fake.
Yeah.
It's not it's not true. It's art is true. Go back to another touchstone that I have. Holden Caulfield is 10, 50, 100 times truer than an actual sociological study of an adolescent. Why? Because the man Salinger was an artist, and he saw the character through artistic eyes. And it's the same way with the actuality is not vision. It's not spirit. It's not art. And so when we lose the word, boy, I think I'd settle for the non-ironic word even.
Well, no, it's true, and I haven't read a play in years, but I'm sure you even see it in the theater. And the theater thrives on words. That's the writer's medium right there. But you still you still get the good character writing on TV. I mean, that's something at least, right?
Oh, it's great. No, it's the salvation. I mean, it's the solace. Have you seen the show Rectify?
Not yet.
Well, absolutely see it, and see it from the beginning. Another show that I can recommend till the last episode, when they probably thought they weren't going to be renewed for a second season. It's called Halt and Catch Fire, and I've fallen in love, it's platonic love, with the actress Mackenzie Davis, who plays this character, Cameron, who is almost a female Jack. She has some of his qualities in her. In fact, I had a letter published in the LA Times when they listed their top 30 young stars, saying I was glad that she wasn't included because she wasn't a celebrity, but the true lovers of acting and quality, she's our star of the future.
Yeah. One more question.
Sure.
And this might take some pondering.
Oh, God. I haven't done any of that. You mean I have to ponder now?
Yeah, put on your thinking cap.
All right.
We talked about all the great, great directors that Nicholson worked with, and they helped shape some very surprising performances from him. Looking at directors of today or yesterday that he didn't work with, who do you think he would benefit the most from having worked with that he didn't actually work with?
Well, I think the man who was ironic from his first breath till his last film, even in his comedies there was an irony, was, of all people, Alfred Hitchcock. And Hitchcock and Nicholson, that would have been interesting, because he wasn't Fonda, he wasn't Jimmy Stewart, but he had an essential character as an actor. And I think Nicholson and Hitchcock, it would have been a fascinating experience. Who are the most humanistic directors? I think Truffaut, the French director, would have found some wonderful things in Jack, or some wonderful things that would challenge Jack in a wonderful manner. And the great directors. I mean, he has worked with so many of them. So I pondered like twofold, and now I'm running out of pondering gas.
You know, I mean, I think somebody like maybe Paul Thomas Anderson could do something unique with Jack, or you know, I'm glad that he finally.
No, he would accept. There's so much in Paul Thomas Anderson that is overwhelming. I think you hit on a director who would have figured an interesting challenge for Jack Nicholson. But I'm just as happy that he never got a chance to.
Well, but and last thing, I'm happy that he was able to work with Scorsese finally. And I'm still waiting for Pacino to work with Scorsese. I'm like, if there's any partnership that seems like a no-brainer, why haven't they worked together? But I'm just sad that it was The Departed. I mean, I think he's just fine. I think he's very good in The Departed. But it seemed another excuse for him to throw everything at the wall and see what stuck. And it seems like another kind of undisciplined, crazy. It doesn't seem like it. He was in another movie, really, at times, I felt. And it's
yeah, that's not among Scorsese's best films.
No, but his first choice for that role, the guy that actually wanted to do it, but he couldn't because he was busy shooting his own movie, was Mel Gibson. And I'm thinking about Mel Gibson in that role in The Departed. I'm thinking that mm-hmm. could have been really interesting. But for some reason, that Nicholson just and I wanted to be. Satisfied.
You would have gotten a little bit of a different approach to the film by viewers and critics and reviewers if Mel Gibson had been in the role instead of Jack.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that the no juice would be allowed on the set if.
Well, I want you to think about this. All work and no play makes Jamie a dull boy. You don't have to worry about that at this point. But be careful.
I've always been dull. I'm fine being dull. You know, from a young age, I was the guy that went across the street and talked to my neighbor. My neighbor was 70 years old. I didn't hang around kids my own age. I went and talked to him. I used to love going to Morrison's when I was a teenager. I mean, I've kind of always been like an old
I think that what anyone says about himself or herself is probably not the truth.
Well, no, that is true. I mean, I'm telling you what I used to do when I was a kid, and you know, and I'm kind
well,
of.
Well, what does now? Wait a minute. What does that make me? I find this dull clod interesting. My God, is there no hope left?
That means that you're just as dull as I am, or if not more.
No, I'm more dull, because I think you're interesting.
My friend, that's why I love you, because, you know, you're a fellow dull soul. I mean, I feel such a connection.